All rise. The judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session.
Okay.
God save the United States and this honorable court.
All right, please be seated. Court will come to order. Good morning. We're here to hear argument in U.S. v. Hardin. Mr. Gill and Captain Porterfield, you're going to be making the argument for the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and are both of you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Mr. Gill, as I understand, you're going to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
That's
argument?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, then you may go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Ken Gale. I represent the appellant in this case, Tech Sergeant Christopher Hardin. The appellant was convicted by general court-martial of one count and specification of unlawful sexual contact with a minor. He was sentenced to a bad conduct discharge, 45 months confinement, and reduction to the grade of E1. In our brief, we raised four issues, including the admissibility of a pretrial statement, the exclusion of evidence related to the accused state of mind after questioning, the legal and factual sufficiency of the evidence, and the appropriateness of the sentence. This court has granted our motion to present issues 1 and 2 by oral argument today, for which we are grateful. I will focus my argument today on issue 1, the admissibility of the pretrial statement, which has within it several issues, the first of which is an interrogation tactic of pre-warning preliminary custodial questioning, the only purpose of which is to induce the suspect to waive his rights, consistent with the requirements of Miranda versus Arizona and Article 31.
Is this the rapport building?
Yes, Your Honor. This is the rapport building issue.
And then what facts in the record do you have to support your statement that the rapport building session was designed to elicit incriminating evidence from the appellant?
Because it can serve no other purpose.
Okay.
The question isn't the purpose of the questioning. It's the purpose for doing the questioning before giving rights. In Miranda versus Arizona, the Supreme Court said that rights must be given at the beginning of custodial interrogation. They didn't say before you ask a substantive question. They didn't say before the...
Is a rapport building session in custodial interrogation? Does it qualify as interrogation?
It does.
And what do you base that on?
Because they ask questions.
So any questions, whether it's designed to elicit any incriminating response, is questions. So if he asked him, did you like the Boston Celtics basketball game the other night, would that be questioning?
Yes, for the purpose, if they're in custody. And for the purpose, I think it's important in a military court to really talk about the question of custody. In court-martial cases, we tend to view custody as irrelevant because it isn't necessary to activate Article 31 requirements. But it isn't irrelevant in Miranda, and although Article 31 and Miranda lie together, Article 31 is, of course, the inspiration for the Miranda ruling to begin with, they aren't the same thing. And we have such a series of military cases about the NCO encountering the accused and the suspect in the barracks and asking him a question, and, you know, non-custodial events. And we get into all these Article 31 cases about what does the nature of that question have to be to Article 31. Does it have to be about the offense? Can you ask him if he needs a drink of water? Can you ask him, you know, where his barracks is, where his locker is located? Those are all Article 31 cases. What I want to encourage the court to do today is to look at this case as a Miranda case, because Miranda heightens the requirements in custodial interrogations, and the Miranda requirements apply to us in the military. And
what source do you have for your notion that any kind of questioning becomes interrogation if the person's in custody?
Well, because they're asking questions, and because the questions are presumably important to the interrogators to determine what they're trying to find out, which is what the suspect knows or will admit to.
I mean, Counsel, there's a case, U.S. v. Gurin. It was reversed on other grounds, but in it, this court upheld a 9-minute preliminary discussion, and after the 9-minute preliminary discussion where they talked about, very similar to this, duty specialty, personal background, educational pursuits, and whether they said that that was not interrogation, and then rights were read, and his subsequent confession was admissible. Do you have any comment about that case with respect to the facts in this case?
I'm not familiar with the Gurin case. Does it post-date Missouri versus Seifert? Is it post-2004?
No, it's a 93 decision.
Well, that would be my first answer, is that before Missouri versus Seifert, and by the way, those of us that are mostly familiar with military criminal practice, the conduct of the Missouri law enforcement officials in Seifert is really amazing, because we've never seen that. But in Missouri versus Seifert, what they did is they actually got a whole confession and then rewarned and then got a whole other confession. And so the facts are different. But it stands for the proposition that what we're talking about here is giving rights at the beginning of custodial interrogation. Custodial questioning, Your Honor. And I think it's important for the purpose of looking at this from a military standpoint that we look at it as custodial interrogation.
So you say Miranda supports that position?
It supports, what Miranda holds is that the Miranda rights must be given at the beginning of custodial interrogation.
Okay.
And so...
Some light, I mean,
well, I don't think the civilian courts, Your Honor, make this distinction you're suggesting between what interrogation is and what questioning is. I think that's...
No, all I'm trying to determine is what qualifies as custodial interrogation.
Well,
obviously, there's no question that your client was in custody.
Yes.
I think everybody sees that.
Yes.
The question is whether or not he was being interrogated.
Well, when he's put in a room, he's in custody, he's put in the corner of the room in a chair with no wheels, he's confronted by two interrogators who are sitting there taking notes and asking him a series of questions, which in this case... And although I'm not sure this is necessary for this particular legal issue, but it certainly is helpful. In this case, included taking him up to the visit to Colorado and to the day of the offense and to establish the circumstance surrounding the offense, and included informing him of the offense he was suspected of, and then intentionally waiting to look for a reaction so that the reaction could be testified to at trial. The special agent in this case who testified admitted that he told him that and then he waited to see what his reaction was. And so those all occurred before rights warnings.
Now, is that last part, is that a question? If he says, hey, you know why you're here because you're suspected.
Well,
of...
and under Article 31, you're supposed to tell them, of course, what they're...
Yeah, but is it a question?
But it is if it's intended to elicit a response. Anything you tell a suspect that's intended to elicit a response, even if it's a statement, qualifies as interrogation.
And okay, what do you base that on?
Well, that's...
I mean, isn't there a difference between statements?
I mean, that's Metcalfe versus Buttamonte, right? I mean, that's been the law for a long, long time. That if you do something in front of the accused that's intended to... That's the Christian burial case. If you say something in front of the accused that's intended to elicit a response, that qualifies as an interrogation.
Well, if you look at MRE 305, when it's talking about the definition of interrogation, it's not just... elicit a response is eliciting a incriminating response. And so asking, what did you do for the holidays? How was that? You know, what did you do for the holidays? I went to Colorado to visit my friend Sergeant Evans. Is that an incriminating response?
I don't want to rest my case on whether that particular question constitutes an interrogation. But it is part of a series of questions. And if I, of course, courts hate hypotheticals and lawyers love them, but if I could create a hypothetical that I think brings the issue in this case sort of into view, what if they had not stopped there before questioning? Okay, you went to the PX. What were the sleeping arrangements in the room where you slept? What happened that night? Did you guys drink? They stayed up and played video games. The host went out and had a smoke. They put the youngest child to bed several times. He went to bed finally. The little girl was not where she was supposed to be. She was in the bed he was supposed to be in, so he just got into bed with her. She was sleeping. He had been drinking. He touched her on the arm. Wait. Now, let's read you your rights. What if they had gotten that far?
But they didn't. So I don't think it's helpful if we just get off on a tangent, because you only have 20-some minutes here.
I understand,
so,
Your Honor.
I think what we ought to do is focus on, you said there was a series of questions. So what were the series of questions that you think led to incriminating responses? That's my question.
Well, the incriminating responses, although the initial two issues, reading him, telling him the offense for the purpose of eliciting a reaction and then testifying about it, there's a incriminating response. Even putting him in at the a vacation spot, although that wouldn't have been hard to prove without it, of course. That is leading towards establishing the facts surrounding the offense. And so they're on their way.
Do you say any of the
it's
report,
part of the interrogation?
What OSI said was report questions. Any of those questions you're saying were inappropriate? All those questions?
Oh, yeah.
All those questions,
oh, absolutely, Your Honor. I think once a suspect is in custody and being asked questions by interrogators, he's got to be read his rights.
Let me ask you this. The first point that you made, which is they told him of the offense, they told him what the little girl alleged, and then they waited for a response. Is there any indication how long they waited for a response?
No, and we don't need it in this case because we have the odd testimony by the special agent that he intentionally waited for a response and there was none. And that actually having that testimony offered at trial as evidence of guilt. And because that's kind of unusual, and so we don't have an indication of what exact technique he had to use.
But your client didn't provide an incriminating response, did he?
Oh, yes, because he testified that he didn't react. That was offered by the prosecution at trial as inculpatory evidence, that he was told what he was accused of and he didn't react. And I don't know whether we all think that's inculpatory or not, but that's how it was used at trial.
Was that during argument? That they made comment?
I don't think so. I think it was during questioning of the special agent. I think what this court ought to look at in looking at this case is the purpose for the rapport session. This isn't, are you comfortable? Do you need a drink? Is your chair okay? They had questions, for example, about taking care of his minor children who needed to pick up to school. The purpose of that rapport session isn't administrative. It isn't something like that. And so, what is its purpose? And it's not just of the rapport session, but what is the purpose of not warning before you do it? I mean, this technique has a purpose. And there's been no suggestion at trial by the government in its response. There's been no suggestion of a legitimate purpose of this rapport building session. This is to soften up the suspect so he's less likely to engage his rights when he's given them.
Well, gosh, these facts seem so different from other cases where it's been criticized of the techniques that the agents have used. This is not a case where they laid out, did the lecture, which is the case that you cited.
The Byers case, yes.
Yes, the lecture, or where they pulled out and showed evidence. They've not said anything about the little girl or the statement that she made in this rapport session. So isn't rapport just what it means, which is making everybody feel comfortable?
Well, and Your Honor, what is the purpose for that? If you read through Miranda and read through Missouri versus Seifert, they talk about what it's like for a suspect to be in a custodial situation being questioned. And how that's a very one-sided, powerless situation to be in, and they require that rights warnings be given before any techniques are used on a suspect to try to get them to talk.
So it's your position then is that the investigators could never engage in a rapport session?
Not in custodial interrogation. I think this question under Article 31 is a little bit different, if it's only an Article 31 question, so that there's not a custodial interrogation. But I think if you put a suspect in a room and you're going to walk in and ask him questions, if you read Missouri versus Seifert, what that case is saying, and Miranda, is they're saying that warning, this isn't a game. It's not a matter of giving the warning at the right time so the accused won't invoke it. That's what Missouri versus Seifert is. That's what Byers is about. It's not a matter of the interrogators trying to game the system so to find a way where suspects won't normally engage their rights.
The investigators did properly advise the appellant of his rights. He just questioned the timing of it.
That's right. I had the unique experience when I argued the U.S. versus Goodson case, where at the Court of Military Appeals, which was later reversed by the Supreme Court, where they argued that a person couldn't invoke their rights because they hadn't been told them yet, which was a unique ruling. And so, yes, timing is important. And because the only purpose of the rapport session is to get the accused to talk to them, that's the purpose of the rapport session, to make him comfortable, to make him talk to them, because that's its purpose. It needs to be preceded by warnings, so the accused knows that he doesn't have to talk to him. And so he isn't softened up first by this rapport session, whatever occurs during it, before making a decision whether to do that after giving his rights. It's the only possible purpose for not warning first. is because they think he'll be less likely to engage his rights if they don't warn him first. There isn't any other reason for it. The Ninth Circuit opinion language is very helpful, which just simply says, in the case that we cited, that a delay in giving warnings, the most plausible reason for the delay in giving warnings is an illegitimate one, which is the interrogator's desire to reduce its effectiveness.
Are there any other circuits that have held that, or the Supreme Court?
The Seifert case hasn't had a lot of activity on this particular kind of issue. I couldn't find anything that was really very similar when I looked, and the government apparently didn't either. And it's a new enough case from 2004 that some of these techniques are probably just kind of being tested under Seifert. I was surprised that Missouri was doing that. Your Honor, I haven't seen anything either directly opponent either for or against this particular proposition. But I do think, you know, the government places in its response this issue under kind of a totality of circumstances test for the confession. And this really isn't that. This is a different question. This is about whether Miranda was violated. And a violation of Miranda requires the exclusion of the evidence.
So are you conceding the point then that the confession was voluntary?
I'm not.
It came on the heels of a proper rights advisement.
Yes.
Your client was not didn't suffer any mental defect.
Well, and we raised two other issues that are relevant to that. One, of course, is fact intensive, and I recognize this court's ability to read the facts in this case, but has to do with the time and the other strains that the accused was under at the time, and those things. And that's correctly looked at under the totality of circumstances test. The other issue is this question of informing at the time of a written statement the suspect that he's writing a letter to his commander. And this is not the first time I've seen that practice either. But I don't think that practice has ever been approved, and I don't think it's proper, because it violates the purpose warning in Miranda.
But how do you get around, when you look at the statement itself, that there are two places where he initialed that this could be used as evidence against me in a trial? I mean, and he's 33-year-old tech sergeant.
Well, he's the way this works is, of course, they do the report session, and then they warn. And then he does an oral statement. Then they say, okay, now it's time for you to write a statement to your commander. So he does that. And then they take him through the second one where he goes and initials. In other words, the written statement is bracketed by warnings, but the first warnings are harmed by the contrary advice that changes the purpose of what he's doing. And the last ones are too late. Post-statement warnings have never been considered adequate. That's closing the barn door after the cow's gone. And in this case, he wrote the statement to his commander. And I don't disagree with the government that the commander would likely have read the statement, but that's not really the point. What Miranda requires, and as we've modified it for Article 31, is actually the other way around, I guess, but he has to be told that this statement can be used against him at trial, and this statement was used against him at trial. And that's what he's got to be told. Not that this is for his commander.
Gosh, this is so contrary when you look at the facts. I mean, this guy was a sharp NCO, over 10 years in the Air Force, a supervisor and a leader. He had his rights read to him in the beginning, and they told it could be used in criminal proceedings. He knows he's being investigated. I mean, he's at OSI. So it's just hard to believe that he would think by them saying, right, so that your commander knows that he doesn't also know that this could be used criminally against him.
Well, that's why we require that be explained, and that requirement applies to everyone, whether it's a senior sergeant or whether it's a lawyer being questioned. They have to be told that the purpose for what you're about to ask you is that it can be used against you in court. That's why we're asking you questions. And what they're telling him waters down that warning, and this court's decision will be whether it waters it down enough. But it's contrary to the purpose warning in Miranda. And there's been no suggestion, for one thing, even though the commander might review it, that isn't why they tell him that. And as to both of these issues, there's simply been no suggestion by the government of a proper purpose for for either of these tactics. For either the tactic of going through a rapport session to make the accused more comfortable or to soften him up, depending on your standpoint. There's no reason not to give a warning before you do that. They haven't suggested one. And there's no reason to tell him that the statement is for the commander. That's not what it's for.
Isn't the commander responsible for disciplinary or discipline within his unit?
Well, sure, Your Honor. And
doesn't that put them, by telling them, hey, you know, write this letter for your commander, doesn't that put him on notice that his commander could take this and take disciplinary action against him?
Well, it isn't sufficient to tell someone that the statement they made may be told to their commander. You've got to tell them is it could be used in a court-martial.
Yeah, but if they're told previously, because obviously your client was told, he was advised on his rights previously.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And if he's subsequently told that, hey, write this statement to your commander, and he knows it's his commander who's responsible for discipline within the unit, correct? So you don't think that puts your client on notice that it could be used against them?
I suppose the commander can mean anyone all the way up to the convening authority, who's certainly also a commander. I mean, it could mean anybody. And the convening authority is the one that decides whether to pursue the charges.
But the commander pushes it, though, right?
Well, the convening authority is a commander, as well as all of his subordinate commanders.
But I'm talking about his unit commander. Unit commander is the one responsible for discipline within his unit.
And for forwarding the charges.
Right.
And I agree with you that it's likely that he would do that, and the accused may know that. He may understand that that process starts with forwarding of charges by the commander. He may not understand that. But that's not what the warnings require him to understand. And it sounds like that when you tell them this, that, okay, we've finished our interrogation now. This wasn't said, but this is what it sounds like. We finished our interrogation. Now we're going to. We'd like you to write a statement to your commander. This has now come down on you. You've done it now, but you know your commander is going to be concerned about you. And soldiers and their commanders. I mean, the commander occupies a very special place with soldiers. Probably the most trusted person in their lives, and they're somebody they want to talk to. And that's the reason for doing this. And however the court rules on this case, tell us what the legitimate reason is for doing that, for telling a suspect being asked to write a written confession that the purpose for this confession is something for your commander to read.
Well, I guess I'm troubled by, I mean, looking at the 1168, they explain to him what it could be used for, and then they tell him that write it to your commander wouldn't that not just emphasize the importance of what the statement is and explain to your client that this is going to your commander? I mean, it's not just going to stay here in the OSI files. So if you write whatever you write, your commander is going to read. Wouldn't that just further explain to him and emphasize to your client the importance of what he writes and to be honest about what you write?
Well, the commander is the airman's or the soldier's primary counselor after, I suppose, his first sergeant.
What do you mean by counselor?
Just personal counselor. Not in the criminal law sense, but the way the service runs. If they have problems, they have family issues, they go to see their commander, and this is the guy that they want to explain stuff to. And it isn't to them, it's to the soldier, it's not part of the criminal justice process. It is to us.
So you're disagreeing with what I'm saying. You think that if you write a letter to the commander, that and somehow is like writing a letter to a consul, like a chaplain?
I think soldiers, not legally, Your Honor, certainly doesn't have that legal effect. And it certainly isn't privileged in any way. But
let me ask you this way. Is it more important to say writing it to a commander versus writing it to your mom?
Actually, that would be a similar tactic, wouldn't it? Write a letter to your mother.
So you're putting a commander and a parent in the same...
Only in the sense that both of them are inconsistent with what they're supposed to be told. It isn't that that's an improper purpose. They're supposed to be told that the purpose for the statement is that it's going to be used, it can be used at a court-martial. That's what they're supposed to be told. Not that it might be read by convening authority, not that we're going to send it to the field to show other people how we do interrogations, not that it's going to be used to line our parakeet's cage.
Are you saying he wasn't told that, or he was told that plus, right?
Yes, he was told that plus. And the
and
question
you're saying
is...
you're troubled with is the plus.
I'm troubled with the plus, yes, Your Honor.
Because it waters down the rights advisement?
I think waters down is the most generous way to put it. I think it contradicts it. It contradicts the rights advisement. It contradicts the purpose section of the Miranda advisement.
I guess my problem is, you know, even if we take it, okay, he was put in a room, and for 25 minutes he worked on this two-page statement. And he asked, could I say something to the victim at the bottom?
Right.
Yeah, you can say something to the victim. And then they come back and they go through, and he's initially, I mean, this is a 33-year-old tech sergeant, very sharp, has his 2 years, I believe, in CCAF degree. I mean, very sharp.
Yes.
He goes through, and one of the blocks that he marks is any statement I make, oral or written, may be used as evidence against me in a trial or other judicial, non-judicial, or administrative proceedings. He didn't have to complete the statement. He could have said, whoa, you know, I thought you told me this was a letter to my commander. Now this form is saying this. I'm not going to sign this. And then we wouldn't have a written statement.
Oh, is that true?
Well, he signed it.
Yeah, but what if he hadn't signed it? You'd still have a written statement. It wouldn't change anything. This would still have come into evidence at trial. That wouldn't even have made it inadmissible unless you decide it would have. But arguably, he was already read his rights. He was told, why statement your commander? What if he hadn't signed all that stuff? What difference would it have made? He's already made the statement.
I see that your time.
Yes, yours, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Government, you may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Captain Naomi Porterfield, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy Weber, represent the United States in this matter. In breaking down appellant's assignment of errors to its basic allegations, appellant has alleged 8 errors that he claims each require a set-aside of the conviction he received in his military judge alone trial. Now, the United States is, of course, believes that each of these issues is wholly without merit, but for purposes of this oral argument, and subject to the court's questions, we'd like to focus on just 2 of those issues. The rapport building questions that issue that appellant raised in his brief, and also the issue of excited utterance and the admission of, or the issue with the statement that appellant made to Master Sergeant Nystrom after his OSI interview. Starting with the rapport building attack that appellant has raised, it's important as a starting point. Appellant referenced the Schneckloth test. All of those factors in Schneckloth, the characteristics of the appellant, the details of the interrogation, they all clearly demonstrate the voluntariness of this confession. We have not some 23-year-old airman. What we have is a 33-year-old tech sergeant. He was step promoted to tech sergeant, NCO of the year. At the time of this interview, he was a security forces augmentee and the emergency response coordinator. This was not an appellant who did not see what was coming.
Well, before you go off talking about that, could you back up and talk to us about the point that was made about this being a custodial interrogation? And from the beginning, they should have read rights. And the appellant is citing us to Missouri versus Siebert. And can you discuss that?
Well, yes, Your Honor. First, I mean, appellant wants to ignore 31, which is broader than Miranda. So if this doesn't violate 31, it's unclear, and appellant offers really no authority for that proposition, why it would violate Miranda. But in Missouri, just like all the other cases, like Byers and Bennett, which are also cited by appellant, those cases involve, in the pre-questioning, when agents are talking about the allegations before rights advisement, or talking around the allegations, like the lecture scenario in Byers. That was not the case here.
So you're saying then it doesn't qualify as interrogation if it doesn't come close to
eliciting an incriminating response. Yes, Your Honor, the very definition. And interestingly, appellant didn't want to rest his case on the definition of interrogation, but that's what this court's required to do, to look at those elements. And this was not at all designed to elicit an incriminating response. What did you do for the holidays?
So what was the purpose of it then?
Well, according to the special agent who testified, who the military judge found to be very credible, The purpose of it was just to relax agents, you know, to make everybody feel comfortable. This was a new agent.
Was that to aid, though, in the investigation? To put the appellant at ease so that he could be more willing to waive his rights, I guess is what I'm getting
at. No, Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record that that was at all the purpose. That's not what the military judge concluded. That's not what the special agent testified to, that this was a softening up to diminish the effectiveness of Miranda. So Miranda itself doesn't preclude this type of questioning.
So then if it's not to soften up the appellant, what was its purpose?
Well,
to put him at ease for what?
According to the special agent's testimony, the purpose of the preliminary questions was merely to just sort of introduce each other, take a deep breath, and sort of, I guess, relax. This is the agent, what he testified to, he actually said it's more for the agents, so the agents can relax, and when they shift gears into reading rights, they can proceed with the interrogation. But he did testify that this was more of a relaxation tool for the agents themselves. That's what the agent testified to, and the military judge found that the testimony of Special Agent Irvin was very credible and reliable.
Well, is it wrong to do something that might put the appellant at ease? I mean, let's say, would you like some water? Do you need to go to the restroom? How are you doing today? Are you sick? How are you feeling? I mean, there's a lot of questions that, you know, you could, I think of, that might be asked in a rapport or just in an introductory type setting. Is that, if the intent is to put the person at ease so they talk, is that impermissible according to the courts?
No, Your Honor. What's impermissible is asking questions or, you know, saying something to elicit an incriminating response, as was the case in Byers with that lecture. But even if there was a clear record that Special Agent Irvin was trying to really comfort and relax this appellant, that in and of itself certainly wouldn't require Miranda or a 31, to be clear, a 31 rights advisement.
Okay, let's say, assuming that's true, but now you've got... There's a question here concerning what you do over the holidays. Now, typically, that type of question may not elicit, and it may not have been the intent to do that, but if it is the type of question that might place the appellant, as in this case, at the scene of an alleged crime, is that not eliciting some kind of that? Doesn't that question somehow elicit an incriminating response?
Well, I'd have to have a two-part response to your question. The first part of my response would be, based on the facts and circumstances of this particular case, there's really no evidence that this was designed to elicit an incriminating response. Appellant did provide more information than was warranted by the question itself.
I can agree with you that, or the court can agree with you, that it wasn't designed to do that.
Right.
My question is, but what if it actually ends up, as we look back on it, that really was an incriminating type question, because it did elicit a incriminating response in the sense that he now admitted where he was, he was actually at the scene of the crime.
Well, given the objective nature of this analysis, we need to look at the question itself. We need to look at whether the question was designed to elicit a incriminating response, regardless of the response that was given. We need to look at that. But even taking those circumstances, even if the court concludes in hindsight that given the fact that this event took place over the holidays, and we're talking 2 weeks after the holidays, but if the court were to conclude that a Miranda warning should have, I apologize, a 31 rights advisement should have been given before the what'd you do for the holidays question, that question does not create a presumptive taint. And when you go to the next step of looking at all of the factors that are required under Schneckloth and all of the other cases that were cited by appellant, there's no evidence that the subsequent rights advisement that was given should preclude the admission and consideration of appellant's oral and written statements that followed.
I'm going to go back away from the question that Judge Helgut asked to talk about. This is 20 to 25 minutes, I believe we read in the record, of rapport building. That's quite a long time of rapport building. And so when you listen to the appellate's argument that this was a technique, and you're saying that the agent was using it to make himself feel more relaxed, that's an awful long time of making the agent make himself feel relaxed isn't it more in line with what the appellant is arguing, that this was a technique that was used to soften him up to make a confession?
Well, Your Honor, let's take a look at the context in which the statement was made. One, this what'd you do for the holidays was one question in that 20 to 25 minute period. But also what was asked, they talked a lot about appellant's career, about his step promotion, about his being NCO of the year, and a bunch of other things. We also have a new agent. He's there with his supervisor. He's taking his time. So when you look at the context, the 20 to 25 minute scenario is certainly not unreasonable and shouldn't cause this court to conclude or deduce that there was some improper motive on the part of the agent.
How long is too long? What if they had kept him there for 2 hours?
Well, Your Honor, I think in the right case that may be a question worth asking, but I think the more important analysis in line with the cases is what questions did they ask? Were they interrogating him? Were they asking questions that were designed to elicit an incriminating response, or were they talking about the Celtics game for 2 hours?
And that would answer the question whether or not he should have been advised of his rights. But I'm just looking at the technique of bringing someone in, establishing a rapport session, and you're saying, you know, when you look at all the facts and circumstances surrounding this 25-minute session, we don't get there. And so I'm asking the question, what if it was an hour? What if it was 2 hours? What if it was 5 minutes? I mean, don't you agree then the length of the rapport-building session is a factor for the courts to consider?
In the right case, certainly. Well, certainly the length of the rapport-building session can be a factor.
Okay, but you don't feel that 25 minutes is in and of itself sufficiently long to qualify as a softening up type technique?
No, Your Honor, and even if this court were to conclude that that was the case, it's certainly insufficient to establish a presumptive taint. So either way, the rights advisement of the statement, keeping in mind here that the response appellant gave to the what'd you do for the holidays question was information that the agents knew. What appellant is claiming were the incriminating statements that followed that question were information that the special agents already knew. So they did not affect the subsequent written and oral statements that appellant provided. And that particular fact was significant to the court's opinion in Bennett and Byers. And so despite appellant's reliance on Missouri and Byers and Bennett, those cases involved a first-part interrogation scenario where they're talking about the allegations, where they're obtaining a confession to the conduct before a rights advisement is given. This is not that case. This is not remotely close to that case, to those cases. So while appellant wants to pick and choose certain lines out of those cases, the analysis themselves supports that this interrogation, this rapport-building session, was done properly. Certainly, appellant wants this court to find what no other court has found, that these preliminary questions are just always, regardless of what's being asked, always improper. And that's simply not the case. That's not the test. It's not the law. The law says that an Article 31 rights advisement is required when an interrogation is defined as questions that are designed to elicit incriminating responses. We do not have that here. And so given those facts and analyzing the cases, this interrogation, this interview was conducted properly, and appellant statements should the military judge should not be found to have abused her discretion.
How do you respond to the argument that after they informed him of why they brought him in, they waited? And then they said during trial that there was no response.
I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor, because I want to clarify that point. When you take a look at the record, it's not that the agents testified that they waited for a response. What they said was there was no reaction. And then the questioner, either trial counsel or defense counsel, reframed the special agent's testimony and said, after you waited for a response, what happened. That waited language comes from counsel. It doesn't come from the special agents. And the significant part that appellant is referring to is when they advised him, when they said, here's the allegation. Are they not supposed to do that? Are they not supposed to say, here's the allegation, here are your rights? By appellants, taking appellant's argument to its logical conclusion, are they not supposed to look when they tell him what he's been charged of? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, is there any indication in the record how long the pause was between informing him of the allegations and then reading the rights?
No, Your Honor. What is in the record, when you look at the 3985, you can see that appellant was told what he was charged with at 1425, or what he was accused of, I apologize, at 1425. And then at 1426, at 1425, he was read his rights and told he was being investigated a violation of Article 120, aggravated sexual contact. And then at 1426, he waived them. That's the only thing that's in the record. And in fact, when defense counsel cross-examined Special Agent Irvin later on, he asked the special agent if the first thing he said was, did you tell him about the substance of the investigation? Like, that CLR made this allegation, or did you just say you're in violation of Article 120? And the special agent testified, all he said was he was in violation of Article 120. He was reading it off the card. So this wasn't a situation where they're telling them about the nature of the allegation as a transition into reading the rights. The telling them about the nature of the allegation was part of the rights advisement. It's part of the questions.
Do you have the page in the record?
Of that particular testimony?
Because I gathered from reading the appellant's brief that there was a statement made before reading rights that this little girl had made an allegation against him.
Right, and that's actually accurate, but then when the defense counsel came back to clarify, That's when he asked those specific questions. Did you tell him that this little girl made this statement, or did you say you were accused of violation of Article 120? And the special agent said, I said it was violation of Article 120. I read off the rights advisement card. And I'd have to get that exact cite for you. I know that the weighted part is in the record at 17 and the record at 535, where they talk about whether he waited for a response. But I can get an exact quotation about the defense counsel's for you, I guess, while they're doing their rebuttal. But in any event, the government certainly believes that taking all of the facts, even if you isolate the rapport building session, there was nothing that was designed. There was no question that was asked that was designed to elicit an incriminating response. A 31 rights advisement was given when it was required, and the subsequent oral and written statements by appellant should be upheld.
Are you going to address this issue too?
Yes, Your Honor.
Wait, before you go there?
Certainly.
There were mention in the appellant's brief about the appellant was acting like he was having an out-of-body experience, and they talked about stressors going on. He stressed about his children. I guess his sister was in a car accident on the very day he was being interviewed by the agents. Isn't this evidence that he was emotionally unstable, and perhaps when we're looking at the totality of circumstances that maybe the confession was involuntary?
Well, Your Honor, certainly those would be factors for the court to consider. They were factors presented before the military judge. What she ultimately found was that despite the significance that the appellant used to bring those up in hindsight, during the interview, he didn't really seem all that bothered by it. The issue about his child care was resolved. There's little discussion about the car accident scenario that the agents were made aware of. Again, this is an objective test. And so based on the agent's perspective and based on what was made available, I should say, what was told to the agents, what the agents had the opportunity to see, his demeanor, which remained calm throughout the interview, that was reiterated by all of the agents who testified. While those factors are something that this court should consider, those factors don't lead to a conclusion that the military judge abused her discretion in admitting the statement and finding that, based on the totality of the circumstances, that this was an involuntary confession.
So the military judge considered those factors and concluded that, notwithstanding those factors, that the statement was voluntary?
Yes, Your Honor.
And we should give deference to the military judge's ruling, unless it's clearly erroneous?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I mean, the conclusions, these were facts that she considered. So those findings of fact certainly are reviewed under a clearly erroneous standard. The military judges are presumed to know the law. While this court does consider the conclusions of law, the voluntariness of the confession, de novo, there's no evidence that this military judge was acting outside of the range of the possible conclusions, the possible choices she had.
Her findings are supported by the record as well.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you. Now,
shifting gears. Yes, ma'am. In issue two, just briefly, the United States reading of the record is clear that appellant had the opportunity to lay the proper foundation with regard to the timeline of what statements she was trying to admit, and she did not take that opportunity. But the important facts that we'd like you to consider, even if you get beyond that, even if you get to the next step of determining whether there was other statements that could have qualified as an excited utterance, the United States position is that that's simply untrue. There were two categories of statements here. The first category was the statement that was admitted, that appellant told Master Sergeant Nystrom, OSI, man, they're good at their job. He said things to that effect that evening. The record indicates in the motions portion of the trial and an appellant's brief that later he said, OSI got me to confess to things that I didn't do. And those statements were not introduced at findings. That question wasn't asked, and a timeline wasn't established despite the military judge's invitation to do so during findings. The military judge, even if considering whether that statement itself qualifies as an excited utterance, the answer to that question would be no, because it doesn't meet any of the requirements, the three-prong test for excited utterance. It was not spontaneous. It was, at best, the next day, which sometimes could qualify, but under these circumstances, it does not. It's not. It's the product of reflection, which is expressly what hearsay is meant to preclude. By its very words, it was simply building appellant's ultimate failed trial strategy of attacking the validity of his confession. But it wasn't a spontaneous statement that the hearsay exception is meant to allow.
So hearsay considerations aside, you agree then that the statement was relevant?
I agree.
If we could get past the hearsay.
I think that the statements were relevant to the motions hearing, which is why they were admitted and considered in motions.
On the voluntariness of the confession.
On the voluntariness of the confession, yes, Your Honor. But with regard to findings, certainly not, Your Honor. This
That's not something that the trial of fact could determine?
Well, the military judge was the trier of fact in this case. And in this case, the military judge obtained the information about what the appellant said to Master Sergeant Nystrom the day of, immediately following his interview with OSI. And then because trial defense counsel didn't give any additional information about what else she was trying to elicit, her question was, anything else? The trial counsel was confused and made an objection because trial counsel rightly assumed that she was going to get into statements that were made the following day. military judge said, I'm confused, so I'm going to sustain that on foundational grounds. And then the defense counsel sat down. She didn't offer any foundation that would have established that anything else, that the response to the anything else question would have qualified under an excited utterance.
And is the only place we can see what might have been the statements is from the motion section of the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we can see in that section there's supposedly some statements made the next day and then for a two-week period.
Yes, Your Honor. That same reiteration of OSI made me confess to something I didn't do. That was the statement that was made the next day and was made in the days and weeks ahead.
But excited utterance, there's not a specific time cutoff on what makes something spontaneous.
Certainly, Your Honor. But, and of course, the timing is one factor, though, that the court can consider in determining spontaneity. And the first, this is Feldham, the first element in the Feldham test is whether the statement is spontaneous, excited, and impulsive, and not the product of reflection or deliberation. Even looking at, you know, OSI made me confess to something I didn't do, that's reflective. That statement is reflective. It's what they said, the theory of excited utterance is that persons are less likely to concoct untruthful statements when responding to the sudden stimulus of the startling event. That clearly wasn't the case here. This was, again, appellant merely trying to get his trial strategy started by attacking the validity of his confession. The next day is a factor for this court to consider. The language that he used, the fact that he never went back to OSI, a fact that was also included in the military judge's findings of fact, to say, oh, well, that wasn't true. All of the factors would lend themselves to conclude that this certainly was not an excited utterance.
But your main position is that the defense counsel essentially gave up.
Yes, Your Honor.
Didn't pursue it further.
Yes,
so
Your Honor.
First, I think you used the word forfeited at that point.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then you're saying if the defense counsel had proceeded, that the military judge still didn't err because it was not an excited utterance.
Yes, Your Honor.
In the appellant's brief, they talk about that he was in an emotional, visibly shaken and emotional state following the days after his interview with OSI. And therefore, this isn't a product of reflection.
Well, Your Honor, that's not clear in the record because what Master Sergeant Nystrom testified to is that an hour, the record at 6/116, an hour after the interview, when they took him back and they were chatting with him and resolving all those issues that we were talking about earlier, he wasn't anxious anymore. He was fine. That's what Master Sergeant Nystrom testified to. And so the record would support, again, that this is not, these statements do not qualify as an excited utterance. And unless there are any other questions, may I briefly conclude? The military judge properly admitted and considered appellant's voluntary confession. His subsequent self-serving statements that the confession was involuntary were not excited utterance nor admissible under any other hearsay exception. In the end, the evidence in appellant's case is legally and factually sufficient to affirm both the findings and the sentence in his case.
Thank you. Mr. Gale?
Just a few follow-up points. I'm sitting here, based on the court's questions and also on counsel's excellent argument, thinking about what an interrogation is. Interrogation isn't a word like question. You can have a question and you can have questions. Interrogation is a process. What Miranda requires is the giving of warnings at the beginning of a custodial interrogation. It's a process. The process had begun when the rapport building session begun. He was in custody and the interrogation had started. That is an interrogation designed to elicit an incriminating response. It's part of the interrogation. It's not proper to break this interrogation down into its component sentences to decide what conduct requires a warning and what doesn't. That isn't the way Miranda works. I think we know that after Seifert, but after previous cases. I don't think we want to ignore Article 31. We always think of Article 31 as being broader than Miranda, but in a sense it's not. Because Article 31 doesn't require custody, it also doesn't place the heightened requirement on custodial treatment of suspects that Miranda places. And in that sense, Article 31 isn't as strict as Miranda and its progeny. And in this case, we have to be careful, I think, that we don't, in applying Article 31, fail to apply what Miranda really requires, which is a special requirement in the case of custody. Counsel cited the Byers case as an example of conduct elicited that was condemned because it was intended to elicit an incriminating response. That's actually not Byer. Although Byer has this lecture paragraph in it where the interrogator tells the suspect, "I think you did it, and here's what you're here for, and you ought to might as well come clean." The purpose of that paragraph, if you read it, and the finding in Byer, the purpose of the paragraph isn't to get him to confess substantively, it's to get him to waive his rights. That's what the court in Byer was concerned about. And that's why Byer, when you marry it up with Seifert, really gives a good illustration about how to look at this case. And see, in this case, we're not really concerned so much about the incriminating nature of the pre-warned statements. And by the way, I want to correct something I said in a minute about that. But not so much about the incriminating nature of the pre-warned statements. We're concerned about conduct that's designed to get him to waive his rights, to help him waive his rights. And in that sense, it's like Byer, which was, not condemned because it resulted in an incriminating response, because it didn't. The response occurred after the warnings. The problem is that it resulted in, it influenced the waiver of those rights. By the way, I think in Byer they didn't actually exclude the evidence. I mean, it's a pre-Seifert case, and the standards are a little bit different. Here's what I want to correct. The statement of where they waited for a response, I think I said something inconsistent with this, and I don't want to do that. That testimony is during the suppression hearing. And was not admitted on the merits. Now, it's relevant to show that incriminating conduct was elicited from the accused before then he was asked to waive his rights, which, of course, any time you've done anything incriminating before you waive your rights, it affects the voluntariness of the waiver. But I don't want the court to go forward thinking that I said it was admitted on findings, which I think I said, and that's not right. That's just not true. Government seems to suggest that the purpose of this report session is to place the agents at ease, that it's for their benefit. They were new and they needed some time to get to know the guy. This is their forum. They've got him in their office, in a little room, in a chair, in a corner where they're backed up against him. They've got two of them in there. One of them's taking notes. One of them's experienced. The other one's not as experienced. That's the only purpose the government suggests for this process, is that it's there to make the agents feel better. And that's not either a credible or a legitimate purpose.
Did you want to address issue two?
I would say a word about that. Your Honor, you correctly point out there's a proffer issue about whether defense counsel's proffer was adequate to preserve the issue. And I think that's an important question for this court. Military courts, I think, have always looked at defense counsel conduct sort of as a whole at trial, and I agree that it would have been better if defense counsel made a better proffer. What had happened, though, is that in a different part of the Article 31 session, the military judge had just heard this testimony. And so the military judge is ruling against defense counsel, and defense counsel isn't remaking a proffer of evidence that the judge has already heard. And I think it's important to see it that way. Otherwise, we're in a position of having a kind of judge defense counsel, which I don't think is really appropriate. In the heat of the trial, what's happening is defense counsel is making an argument about testimony that although defense counsel falls short of making an adequate proffer at that point, the judge had already heard the testimony.
Well, would your answer be different if it was a trial before members, not just judge alone?
No, because the admissibility of the evidence question would still be before the judge. And so it's a question of the admissibility of the testimony, not its weight. And so it wouldn't be different.
Before a judge should rule, we shouldn't hold the defense counsel to a full proffer, appropriate proffer, when the judge already knows from the previous testimony in motions
what
really is going to try and be elicited here.
I think that rule would be fair to defense counsel. I can't cite any law to support that, but I think that would be a fair rule. And the other thing I had to say about that is, remember, when we're talking about the voluntariness of this confession, we're not only talking about its admissibility, we're talking about its weight. And if you'll read our sufficiency argument, this is a confession that was as much created by the questioners as by the suspect. And the weight of the believability of at least portions of this statement are really important about where they came from. And the interrogator's testimony about the demeanor of the accused, he was calm, he was collected, is completely contrary to the demeanor of his first sergeant found him in when he picked him up. It's really important evidence. I mean, this evidence about whether he thought he'd been overborne in the questioning is really, really important to this case. And in that sense, the hearsay consideration, and there's some question about exactly when he made the statement about they made me say things I didn't do. But it was within this period where he was upset after the questioning, and I think critical enough that this kind of evidence ought to be admitted. Thank you.
All right, counsel. Thank you for your outstanding briefs and also your outstanding arguments. And this court will issue an opinion in due course. This happens to be my last argument, at least for some time, that I'll be having. Let me just put on the record that I've thoroughly enjoyed practicing both sides. You guys have done an outstanding job. Did you?
I echo the same. It's my last hearing as well. So very good.
And mine too.
Mine too.
Is that right? So it's been quite enjoyable working with all of the parties. Excellent work products, great courtroom demeanor, and we really do appreciate it. So, thank you.
All right. With that, the court is adjourned.
All right.
Excellent job.